Got 15 minutes to spare? Then you've got time for Extra Easy, our new short, sharp sister show to The Speakeasy with Annie and Carla.
Well, hello, Annie. It's Extra Easy time again. How are you?
It is. I'm very well for a Monday. How are you today,
Yeah,
Carla?
It is a Monday, isn't it, though? I think we were just having trouble working out what day of the week.
What day it is, I know.
They all just blur into one.
It is. Anyway, crawling out of the weekend.
That's
so,
right.
So, Extra Easy time, Fast and Furious. What have you been noticing recently? Anything caught your attention?
Oh, yeah, definitely. This huge furore over the recent Cochrane review on new Hep C DAA treatments. Have you caught up with this as well?
Totally, yeah. It's a really interesting discussion, huh?
Oh, very, very
timely in many ways, probably to be expected a little bit, but good to have the discussion.
And, you know, it's terrific to see our colleagues kind of enthused and motivated and
rise to the occasion,
yeah,
hey?
To make lots of comment in a variety of fora. But it's also attracted some popular interest. There was an article in The Guardian, and I'm sure there's other outlets as well. And you do wonder what kind of impression that makes on people who may not be up with the info or the data behind this. So
Agree. Yeah, go back a little bit. I think that would be good. Okay.
So the Cochrane collaboration, perhaps we should start there, is it's been around maybe for two decades or so. And people submit a plan of what they want to do, and then that's peer-reviewed, and then they do the review, and that's peer-reviewed. And it's a Cochrane review is supposed to be best practice in looking across all the published paper, choosing, weeding out those that are low quality, choosing those that are high quality, and making a sort of discerning statement of whether something works or whether something has impact. And so that was done, that process was done for new DAA treatments, yeah?
Well, and how does that, do you know how that comes about, Carla, that how something gets selected to be the focus or why that would happen?
I'm not
It's just a matter of interest or something, but someone has an interest in an issue and
and they put up a proposal.
Just do it. Perhaps, yeah, something like that. Yeah, right.
So the these people, Jacobson and colleagues, proposed to look at this effect of DAAs, and part of it is what they chose to look at as the endpoint. So, you know, we're very focused on sustained virological response, usually measured 12 weeks after treatment or so, which is a measure of whether virus is detectable.
And so
they said, yeah, okay, SVR. But then they also went in to look about whether new Hep C treatments produce changes or the impact that we would want in decreased morbidity and mortality. So do fewer people die after they've received Hep C treatments, for example? And they couldn't find an effect. So their conclusion was, you know, we're not sure if these things have a clinical effect. And that's one of the points that the sectors jumped on of saying, of course, we can't know this because they haven't been around long enough
to
follow people to death if that was to occur.
Yeah, that's right.
And the idea that this information from the Cochrane Review is held in high esteem because it is a Cochrane Review, but perhaps giving out information that, you know, on the face of it is probably true because there isn't enough data on which to make the decision of do these things affect death rates or not. But there is the strong...
But it's more complex than that, isn't it?
Much more complex. And
there's
sort of also
as it always is,
questioning whether or not SVR is an appropriate proxy measure of effectiveness of treatment or cure. And I remember having this conversation when I first started working in the sector a very long time ago about could you use the word cure in relation to SVR. Maybe you remember that too, Annie.
I do, very much so, yep.
And,
what is a cure and what does that mean for different people and,
And particularly with something like Hep C, where people will always have antibody status, regardless of the cure in inverted commas. You know, it's a difficult concept perhaps for some. So, you know, it'll be interesting to watch this Cochrane thing roll out. That's the technical term, the Cochrane thing.
Yeah. But it is, as you say, Carly, you know, it is a really it will be interesting to watch it, because these things, you know, to use a very famous economic term, you know, they trickle down, so yeah, to right. speak. And so, you know, maybe not everyone, you know, Joe and Joanne out on the street won't yep. necessarily, you know, understand or even know about the Cochrane Review, but they may well kind of through other means hear that there's been a question put over the sort of efficacy of these treatments in terms of, you know, preventing death or whatever, yeah. and you know that how that gets translated on a street level and stuff is hard to know, isn't it? But at the moment, while we're trying to really encourage people to take a new look at Hep C treatment after a long time of having not very attractive treatments available, yeah, it's could have an undesirable impact. And particularly in countries, hey, where they're yeah. not yet at that point. Yeah.
And I was just been looking at, there was a letter published by our colleagues from Melbourne, Joe Doyle, Alex Thompson, Peter Higgs, Mark Stuve, Paul mm-hmm. Dietz and Margaret Hillard. Hello all, I'm sure yeah. you're listening.
Regularly.
And their letter to The Lancet sort of hit on that point that you just mentioned, you know, failure to treat individuals while waiting for the direct evidence of long-term clinical outcome data will lead to substantial and avoidable excess mortality and morbidity globally. So, you know, yeah. we wouldn't yeah. want this kind of stuff to stop prescribers prescribing while they wait for the, you know, definitive answer on whether or not this exactly. prevents deaths, meanwhile exactly. creating deaths because of that delay in
exactly.
prescribing.
Yeah. So it raises a really important point about yeah. about research of this kind and how it happens and gets promulgated, doesn't it?
Have you been looking at?
Well, it's not sort of a million miles away, even though it's a very different topic, but it goes to this issue of the backstory behind the yeah. data, maybe a little bit, which I think is kind of probably an interesting cross. So recently, the last week or so, the WHO, the World Health Organization, and the UN, United Nations, have put out a joint statement. Now, this basically on supporting this sort of calling for and supporting countries to decriminalize drug use uh-huh. and drug possession right. For personal level use. It wasn't a statement just on this topic. It was actually kind of sort of buried a little bit within another joint statement that was on a broader issue around discrimination in healthcare settings, actually. But what's interesting about the making this statement within that one is that generally it's not the first time that these two bodies have made some comment on drug decriminalisation yeah. and, you know, decriminalisation of possession and personal possession. But it's generally in the context of public health and HIV prevention and that sort of thing.
Yep.
And this time, I guess, putting it in this statement around discrimination in healthcare settings, it really squarely puts it in a human rights context. Mm. So I think that's the kind of new bit of this statement.
Was that a statement on discrimination in health settings about drug use or broader than that?
No, not drug use per se. It was more broad. It actually was associated with the Sustainable Development Goals, uh-huh. which have kind of grown out of the Millennium Development yeah. Goals that were predecessors. But we now have the Sustainable Development Goals, and one of those is the aim is to ensure that no one is left behind, yeah. so to speak. And so it was put in that context. So in itself, really interesting that it kind of was seen as a critical issue to put in a broader statement around discrimination in healthcare settings. And as I say, important also because it shifts their focus to a human rights sort yeah. of argument about why this needs to occur, so not just a public health kind of benefit. So not super surprising, though, that it is coming out, because the Secretary General, of course, of the UN at the moment, Guterres, was the Prime Minister, I think it was, of Portugal when all the changes were made there to the laws. So there is a context to this that I think is kind of understandable. Mm-hmm. But it happened anyway. So that's kind of been getting quite a bit of social media profile and people talking about it and what it might mean and encourage and et cetera. And in that context, here at home in the last week or so, we've also seen the release of the latest illicit drug report
yep.
in Australia, which is done by the Australian Criminal Intelligence Commission.
Yep.
And so they put them out regularly. But what's interesting about that, so that Gino Wumbaka, who's the president of Harm Reduction Australia, and I should just declare that I'm on the board of that organisation, but he wrote a really interesting piece in response to the release of this report in the Huffington Post. Just during the week. And yeah, really, really great piece. So I thought it was worth mentioning, and because it does sit in this same context around the whole issue of drug decriminalisation, and that's what it was focused on, but focused very much on some of the statements and data and findings in this latest report. And basically what he was sort of saying is that the government, through the Minister for Justice at the federal level, was basically saying that the increase in drug seizures in Australia over the last 10 years is basically a clear measure of success of Australian law enforcement in relation to illicit drugs and pointed to things that, like, you know, seizures have increased by 85% and the weight of drug seizures has also increased by, you know, something like 75%, I think it was. And but the point is, and what Gina was saying, is that those figures belie the kind of truth behind the data or the story, the backstory behind this data. And that is that those seizures, even if they are increased, even if they are bigger than ever before, actually represent, you know, but a drop in the ocean. And they have had no discernible impact on price, purity or availability on the street, which is what you would measure, I think, if you thought those things were really having some sort of impact. But in fact, really, some drugs have become cheaper and more available, in fact, over that time.
And this is not a new story, right? You know,
it's not a new story.
That big story of, you know, look at these grand seizures. Oh, I can't even get that work out.
It's a tricky one, actually.
Oh, gosh, I think I just blushed. You know, really big drug busts and little impact on what happens on street level. Yeah. So
absolutely.
I mean, and there's always, you know, the lies, damn lies and statistics. Statement, isn't it? You choose any measure and it will tell the story. If you choose wisely, it'll tell the story that you want it to.
Totally, completely. And like I guess I would finish on this to say one of the other stories talking about damn lies and statistics is the government also is saying that the increase in arrest rate, which has increased by 85% in the last 10 years in illicit drugs, they're seeing that as a success of law enforcement. But, of course, the backstory behind that figure as well is that the vast, vast majority of those are consumer arrests, like something like, you know, three quarters of them or more are arrests of street-level users, not suppliers and certainly not high-level suppliers as they, you know, the Mr. Bigs as they so often talk about. And so, and most of those, I think at least half of them are cannabis users as well. Right. So, you know, it really shows, I guess once you dip into these figures, what you see is a very different picture. And one of the things the article was saying is no wonder the public is really confused about this and has a really is unsure about which way to proceed and decriminalisation or not, or more law enforcement or not, because all these figures are thrown around and they present really different pictures depending on, you know, how you present them. So, yeah, I guess there's some, you know, the issue of decriminalisation of illicit drugs is not going away. It's being discussed more and more and more, and we're yet to see any real movement here in Australia, but, you know, some people believe it's only a matter of time, I guess we'll see.
Yeah, I mean, my heart just sinks when you say things like, you know, increases of 85% in arrests. You know, you just think, what a waste on so many levels.
Absolutely.
It's heartbreaking, isn't it, for people whose lives are stuffed up permanently or for a period of time whilst they fight things in court and spend money they don't have on lawyers who may or may not be effectual and court costs and prison costs and family dislocations and, you know, all the greater harms that are produced.
And all, as the article indeed says, money that actually could be redirected to services that people genuinely need and want, harm reduction services, drug treatment services, if we were to kind of learn the lessons from alcohol prohibition almost a century ago now. And decriminalise and legalise, et cetera, and regulate. So I guess it's a wait and see space. I'm sure we'll talk about it a lot more to come. But a couple of key moments over last week in that space, I reckon. Mm.
And as always, we'll put links to these things on our website, and hopefully let people go and have a read and make up their own minds about this stuff as well. And
there's a couple of things, yeah.
Seek some further stuff if they are interested. So catch you next time.
All right. See you then.
Bye.
Bye.
For more information about this podcast, our guests, and upcoming episodes, head to http://csrh.arts.unsw.edu.au.